Hello, my name is David Hart. I'm the Director of the Online Library of Liberty at Liberty Fund. I'm talking today to Professor Dennis O'Keefe, who's Professor of Social Science at the University of Buckingham and a Senior Research Fellow in Education at the Institute for Economic Affairs in London. He's published widely in the area of education and the social sciences. I'd like to talk to Dennis about his book published by Liberty Fund. He translated Benjamin Constant's Principles of Politics Applicable to All Governments, which was first published in 1815. Dennis, what's Benjamin Constant's book about?
It's about the conditions of liberty and why they must be universally applied by governments, whether monarchical or republican, because Constant believes that one step in the direction of arbitrary government is a step on the road to despotism, and that governments slip into despotism bit by bit. Therefore, the citizens must always be very wary of the limits of government and insist absolutely and unflinchingly on those limits.
Who is the despot he was referring to?
Well, the despot could be a king, could be a president, could be an arbitrary ruler. He doesn't necessarily specify, but anyone who transcends the general rules of limit is a potential despot. I think his view is that, on the whole, during the course of history, despotism has given freedom a very bad time. More governments and more societies in historical time have been despotic than have been free.
Why did you translate this book at this time?
Well, partly because I'd got into the way of translating to some degree through my connections with various intellectuals and presses in Europe. I'd done a little bit, but mostly because I was at a Liberty Fund conference on Benjamin Constant, run by Dr. Simon Green, and one of the Liberty Fellows there, Dr. Emilio Pacheco, asked me to do it. I thought about it. It seemed an enormous job, but quite an exciting prospect, so I took it on.
Why is Benjamin Constant important to our understanding of liberty?
Because of his theorizing, because of the eloquence with which he pinpoints what freedom means for the law and what the law means for freedom, what freedom means for private property and the limits of taxation, what overmighty government means as a threat to civilization, culture, religion, and all the rest of it.
Now, he was writing almost 200 years ago. What does he have to say to us today?
He fundamentally has to say that we beware of excessive government. He says that politics is guided by freedom. Freedom is a brake on government when it starts to go astray, but also it is a stimulus to government when it starts to flag, when it doesn't feel so much despotic as despondent. I don't know if he uses the word, but Constant often suggests that what goes wrong with government is kind of apathy. And he speaks of the government initially silencing the people through brutal means, and then itself falling asleep with them, which, when you think about it, is a wonderful description of what happened to the Soviet Union. For the first 40 years, there was most horrendous coercion, and then a kind of slide into a miserable, wretched, lost apathy on both sides.
So he would be one of those classical liberals who thinks that a vibrant parliament and an active free press is important to keeping government on track.
Yes, he says that without a free press, all decent options are off. And that's the basis of his quarrel with de Bonald, who thought that once you've got representative government, you didn't need a free press. Constant's view was that they go together. Representative government and freedom of expression are part of the same phenomenon of intellectual modernity, really.
So when he was writing the Principles of Politics, he was living under Napoleon's empire, where the press was restricted quite considerably.
Yes. His attitude to Napoleon, had a little of the trimming about it.
By that you mean he was writing in a way not to offend the censors too much?
He makes, on several occasions, he actually conciliates Napoleon by saying, "We, after all, we live under the government of a man who has just said that freedom of the press is an indispensable means of modern civilization." He trims a little bit. Once Napoleon is down and out, he gets much harsher in his judgments. But I think this is understandable.
But he wasn't trimming when he called Napoleon a tyrant and a usurper.
No, that's true. But I don't think he actually did that at the time. I don't think. I don't think he did that while Napoleon was still in power.
Benjamin Constant has been described as the French Edmund Burke. Why is that? Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, because there is the same uncompromising commitment to the free society based on an implicit rather than explicit view that freedom is the proper human medium, and it is we're talking about an animal whose ontological nature is a free one. Neither Burke nor Constant fleshes this out, but we can feel that that's what they think, that freedom is our medium, this is where we belong, and although we may not have had that medium to enjoy throughout much of history, that this is the proper context for us.
And Benjamin, Edmund Burke became famous for writing his reflections on the French Revolution. It's interesting that Benjamin Constant is also living through this period.
Yes.
What was Benjamin Constant's reaction to the at least to the first phase of the French Revolution?
I think he initially, for about a year, maybe a bit more, he was sort of hopefully on side. Then
many liberals at the time. Yeah.
Then it all seemed to go astray. It all went out of control, and he then speaks of the despicable despotism, and really has nothing good to say about it at all after that point. He talks about hired assassins, and men, thousands of men executed without due process, and the murder of the king, which he found an appalling event, and so on. But also he's concerned with the ideological demands of the revolution, which requires innocence to abandon itself, which requires people to say that they're guilty of sins they can't possibly have committed, which of course links the French Revolution with communism, just as other aspects of it, for example, the ready access to military conquest, the reliance on military conquest as a way of spreading power and seizing resources, links it to Nazism. So it clearly links up for him with the two great 20th century forms of totalitarianism.
So that's another reason why Benjamin Constant still speaks to us.
He speaks to us because of those links.
Yeah. What was his attitude towards the rise of Napoleon? A number of liberals at the time saw him as a possible saviour after the turmoil of the terror. Do you think Benjamin Constant viewed Napoleon in this way?
Yes, I do. And there are writings other than the Principles of Politics which suggest this. I couldn't name them, I can't remember them offhand, but I have read it. And I think in any case there's no doubt that he thought that Napoleon was a much better political bet than the committee or Robespierre and so on. The Committee of Public Safety is really the forerunner of the modern 20th century totalitarian political apparatus. I think that although he would rather have a liberal society than either the revolutionary government or Napoleon, he would prefer Napoleon to the revolutionary government.
Like a lot of liberals of his time, he's fascinated by constitutional government and the need for constitutional government to solve the turmoil of French politics. French liberals seem to be torn between those who turn to the British model and those who turn to the American model. Which one was Constant?
He was very well disposed to both. He thought that with the settlement of 1688, the Whig grandees had managed to impose a permanent bloc on royal power, as well as the kind of republican terrorism that had developed under Cromwell. He's even more favorably disposed to the American experiment, partly because he's a Republican, and partly for the same reasons as Machiavelli, that republicanism is, in a sense, more appropriate than a traditional political system like monarchy to modernity. But he thinks you can have a very civilized form of royal government, and he likes constitutional monarchy.
But as long as the king is willing to accept the constitutional limits on his power.
I think Constant, if asked, he doesn't say, but I think Constant, if asked, would have said that a constitutional monarchy would have been the way out of France's troubles. Would have been certainly much better than what in fact transpired. But he thinks in the case of the United States, there's a kind of clean break has been made. Indeed, for my money, Constant fails to spot the essential continuity between British and American civilization. I think he probably knew it, but he doesn't say it. Mm. And I've often wondered why he didn't say it.
He also writes a lot about the importance of religious toleration and religious liberty in a constitutional state. Yes. Why is he interested in religion?
Well, partly because he regards the world as mysterious and probably regards the final and ultimate truths, whatever those may be, as unreachable by men. He thinks the world is mysterious and that we therefore must have a kind of reverence to these eternal questions. Why am I here? What must I do? What is my duty to my fellow men? And he says that human beings turn to religion in their moments of stress, and that indeed all our ultimate consolations are religious ones. He also says, however, that highly educated men and women can retain their moral order without specific religious belief, and he rather doubts whether less educated people can, which suggests that to some extent his approach to religion is a utilitarian one. I think he's not an atheist, nor even provenly an agnostic, but he certainly prefers Protestantism to Catholicism, and he clearly thinks Protestantism is a more modern version of Christianity than Catholicism, and Constant's a modern. Constant believes that the British and the Americans have invented modernity, and he likes it and wants to go with it.
But he doesn't want to see the state legislate that one particular form of religious practice is to be the official religion.
No, I think he probably would have approved of France's having a secular republic in as it does, but I think he would prefer the American secular republic because it has coexisted with religion much more successfully than France. French governments have often been, with some exceptions, often been headed by atheists and people who wanted the church to die, as it, in fact it has largely died in France, it seems to me.
When he was writing this book, France had been involved in a series of wars of conquest of Western Europe. What was his attitude towards war in general and to the Napoleonic attempt to bring liberty, quote-unquote, to the European people by force of arms?
Well, that's a complex question. He would have said that the objective is itself unrealizable. You cannot force people to be free in that way. At the same time, he is full of admiration of the French military prowess of that period, praises again and again the extraordinary courage of the French working class and peasantry on the military front. And we can only wonder today how that all got dissipated. The French were the most brilliant soldiers in the world in the 18th and early 19th centuries, and somehow they lost their way. He says war is in man's nature, and it is not necessarily bad, and indeed there are noble things about war, but he believes that with the development of commercial civilization, war has become too expensive. We don't need it as a system of plunder anymore, he claims, pointing out that the Greek city-states and the Roman Empire lived by military plunder. He empirically underestimates the importance of trade in the ancient world as it happened, but he's quite right that there was a good deal of military predation. On the other hand, he's wrong in thinking that it's gone because some world of commerce has arisen. In the first half of the 20th century, the Imperial Japanese and Nazi Germany created far worse and more predatory military grab machines than antiquity ever had. And the communist encroachment, opportunistic grabbing, was another version of territorial expansion. So it hadn't died in the way that he assumed it had died.
Hmm. You have selected a number of passages from the book that you think are particularly important. Would you like to share some of those with us?
Yes, I'd like to say something about his thoughts on mediocrity. He was very, Constant's very concerned to say that government should spring from enlightened men, but it is only a minority of enlightened men. The majority of the minority must be carefully fixing their eyes on the minority of the minority. In other words, government and the checks on government both come from the educated class. And the thing he feared above all was that mediocrities, and he would have said men of iron will like Robespierre, nevertheless intellectually mediocre, are the kinds whom you must resist. He says this, people always take mediocrity as peaceful. It is peaceful only when it is locked up. When chance invests it with power, it is 1,000 times more incalculable in its motion, more envious, more obstinate, more immoderate, and more convulsive than talent, even when emotions lead the latter astray. I think that is something that you can see in any office, in any university.
Very interesting.
In any political circumstance. And in the history of totalitarianism, it is almost a dominant theme how the great and the brilliant, like Sakharov or Solzhenitsyn and so on, get marginalized or driven into exile or put into ghastly labor camps and so on, whilst people of, usually of intellectual mediocrity, but always of spiritual and moral mediocrity, come to the top.
And there, during the period that he's talking about and lived through, there were many great people, many liberal-minded people who were forced into exile,
yes,
or even executed for their views.
Yes.
During the Terror, for example, the, yes, Jacobin reign.
That's true. It picked on people who might resist. There's a kind of a piecemeal picking off of the sources of resistance. And again, Constant was much too optimistic, he thought, because educated people had seen these appalling events of the French Revolution, that they'd say, well, thanks, we're not going to have any more of that. Unfortunately, it turned out to be the opening shot of a far worse upsurge of despotism in the distant future. In 1917, this terrible totalitarian hatred broke out in Russia, spread, mutated into Nazism. That flourished horribly for 12 years and then was defeated. And communism really ruined the 20th century, lasting as it did until almost to the 80s.
Thank you for that. Do you have another passage you wanted to share,
yes,
with us?
Yes, there were one or two others. He says of political freedom that it has two functions. First of all, it serves as a barrier to government, but it also supports it. And here's the quote, political freedom, which serves as a barrier to government, is also a support for it, guiding it on its way, sustaining it in its efforts, moderating it in its onsets of madness, and encouraging it in its moments of apathy. When he talks about freedom, he specifically aims at a narrower range than we would because of not the absence of mass media and so on, but he says you must have a free press. and his words are, all defences, civil, political or judicial, become illusory without freedom of the press.
Yes, that's all.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis, for talking with us today and sharing your thoughts about Benjamin Constant.
Well,
is there any final thing you'd like to say about him?
Yes, I think if somebody had translated the whole corpus of the 1806, 1810 manuscripts on which the French publication of 1980 is based, if someone had done that translation 100 years earlier, he would have been extraordinarily well known now. It might even have prevented or helped to slow down the decline of French liberalism.
What's been the reception of your book since it was published?
I can't tell you about the sales, although I was told that they've been quite good. It got very good reviews, in which a common theme was, here's somebody who asserts the greatest truth about the modern free society, that its essence is the rule of law, and that one should under no circumstances depart from the rule of law. And although we know all governments, even good ones, do, we should always expose them when they do, if we find out.
Do you think there's been a rediscovery of Constant in the last 10 years?
In part, partly helped by earlier work in the Cambridge series on political philosophy. There isn't a great deal of interest in his native France. I know he was a Swiss, but he regarded France as his home. There hasn't been much interest in France. There's been more in the USA. Actually, there's more American interest in French liberalism than there is anywhere else on earth, I think.
It's a curious fact, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, I think so. Myself and my colleague at Buckingham, Norman Barry, are very interested in French liberalism.
What research are you currently doing at the moment?
Well, I'm actually doing some work on Bastia, and I'm attempting to build up my portfolio of knowledge about French liberalism. I'm doing some semi-translation, I would call it, of Bastia. But I do other kinds of work. I'm also doing some empirical sociology of education. I'm investigating the whole problem of compulsory education and truancy from school and class.
For younger scholars, what areas of research do you think are the most important today for increasing our understanding of liberty?
Well, I think we need to conquer sociology. I think we need to regain the kind of sociology that was on track when great writers like Durkheim and Weber were working in the field. And I don't care at all that Durkheim was a socialist. He still believed in the free society. And Weber unerringly believed in the free society. And what happened in the 20th century was that the Marxists stole the subject and ruined it, really, pretending that Marx was a great sociologist and that all the answers were there. And I think the worst thing that they've done is that scholars in the Marxist and Marxisant tradition, even when they weren't Marxist proper, have brought into academia not only terrible obfuscation, so that the works that get published are scarcely comprehensible, whether they're trying to tell the truth or tell lies. Not only that, they have spread a terrible cynicism about the world. They have taught people to believe that nothing is what it seems, that everything is some awful substructure or underlying body of menace, which experts who've read Foucault or Derrida can tell us all about them. I think Constant, a very good example of his admiration for English and American civilization is his liking for their philosophers. He thinks the way they do, that everything is what it is and not some other thing.
Well, once again, Dennis, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.